It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
He's like Clarence Thomas, black Republican who believes in pulling yourself by your bootstraps, rather than, to me, understanding the systemic racism that African Americans face in this country and other minorities. He doesn't get it, neither does Clarence.
Right.
And that's why they're Republicans.
That was The View's Joy Behr last week, saying that presidential candidate Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, who is black, doesn't understand the black experience in America. Today, Tim Scott made an interesting decision to go on The View to have a conversation about it. Now, The View can be a contentious, even a hostile place for conservatives and Republicans, so why would Tim Scott choose to put himself on The View? So for the next half hour, we're going to dig into this. We're going to look at why Senator Scott's message just might resonate with a lot of The View's audience. And then we're going to go past the politics of it all. We're going to have former Representative Mia Love join us to talk about her experience. She was a guest host on The View multiple times. She understands that. But ultimately, we're going to do what we always try to do and transcend the politics of it all, get past the identity politics of it all, and start talking about how can we have a better conversation about race. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
So settle on in. We're going to have an interesting conversation here. So, of course, we started with Joy Behr, the very outspoken, one of the hosts on The View, calling out an African-American senator from South Carolina, saying that he didn't understand the black experience in America today. Senator Tim Scott responded on social media and in other places, but then chose to go on The View today to actually talk about it. And I think he did it in a pretty interesting and a pretty extraordinary way. And so we're going to dig into that. But it's more important than just The View. It's way more important than The View. And it's even more important than a presidential politic race. It's about how we have conversations about race, discrimination, bigotry, and identity politics here in the country. So stay with us. Over the next half hour, we're going to dig into this, including former Representative Mia Love, who will join us coming up at 1:20 to talk about her unique experience, having been on The View multiple times as one of those hosts, and her conversations about race in America. So let's start with Senator Scott today. Again, he chose to go on The View. Interesting dynamic. Joy Behr was actually taking the day off. So he wasn't looking face-to-face at Joy Behr to have that conversation. But he got asked some pretty pointed questions in terms of his background and his understanding of race in America. And Tim Scott began by explaining why he wanted to come on the show.
And one of the reasons why I'm on the show is because of the comments that were made, frankly, on this show, that the only way for a young African-American kid to be successful in this country is to be the exception and not the rule. That is a dangerous, offensive, disgusting message to send to our young people today, that the only way to succeed is by being the exception. I will tell you that if my life is the exception, I can't imagine.
But
it's not, actually.
It's been 114 years.
Yeah, so the fact of the matter is we've had an African-American president, African-American vice president. We've had two African-Americans to be secretaries of the state. In my home city, the police chief is an African-American who's now running for mayor. The head of the highway patrol for South Carolina is an African-American. In 1975, there was about 15% employment in the African-American community for the first time in the history of the country. It's under
5%. 40% homelessness.
And 50%
of
the folks in our community.
13% of the population.
You had a chance to ask.
So very interesting. You can see that Senator Scott was very prepared to come on with some specifics and with some statistics to take on some of the sweeping generalities there. And I thought one of the most interesting things he said in that opening comment was that it's dangerous. It's dangerous to have that label as being the exception. And obviously, Tim Scott, if you're not familiar, he has his own story. His grandfather worked in the cotton fields. He was raised by a single mother, and he did work his way through. And he did experience some racism. He did experience some targeting. So he does get it, actually. He's lived it. And I think that's an important piece of the equation. But that idea of sending the message that you have to just be the exception, it's going to be a luck of the draw, is not the right message. And granted, there are things that need to change. Things need to be absolutely overhauled for sure. Tim Scott went on to say, though, that we can measure progress in this country just by the generations.
I'm going to suggest the fact of the matter is that progress in America is palpable. It can be measured in generations. I look back at the fact that my grandfather, born in 1921 in Sally, South Carolina, when he was on a sidewalk, a white person was coming, he had to step off and not make eye contact. That man believed then, with some doubt now, in the goodness of America, because he believed that having faith in God, faith in himself, and faith in what the future could hold for his kids would unleash opportunities in ways that you cannot imagine. Every kid today can look, just change the stations and see how much progress has been made in this country. ABC, NBC, CBS, ESPN, CNN, Fox News all have African-American and Hispanic hosts.
So again, he was very specific in terms of what he targeted and pointed out. And again, just by the generations, just what his grandfather had to do versus where he's walking today. Tim Scott was also asked quite pointedly about America and whether or not it's met its promise as outlined by the founding fathers.
So America has met its promise.
No, of course, the concept of America is that we are going to become a more perfect union. But in fact, the challenges that we face 50 years ago and 60 years ago should not be the same challenges that we face today. And here's a way that you measure that. When my mother was born, about 10% of African Americans got a high school degree, diploma. Today, it's over 90%. When you look at the income, success
that
we've had.
That's an HBCU stat.
Well, listen, HBCU stat is a good one, because one of the reasons why I took the funding for HBCUs to the highest level in the history of the country, and then I helped make it permanent, is because I believe that education is the closest thing to magic in America. So I'm about making sure that our kids have as many opportunities to succeed as possible.
So really important there in terms of what Senator Scott was laying out, that look, there is progress, there is things that are happening, and we still need to continue to have the conversation. But just having the conversation in pejorative lace things between Democrats and Republicans isn't advancing the conversation for anybody. Now, one of the hosts of The View, Whoopi Goldberg, asked Senator Scott to say that the Republican Party wants to stop progress against systemic racism. Here's a very interesting exchange.
You yourself have talked about when the police stopped you.
Absolutely. And
so how can you get your party to stop trying to stop the progression that people are making?
Yeah, so,
that's what I complained about when I spoke about. Yeah. I want you to come out and say, listen, the Republicans have these issues. So
yeah, I think humans have these issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. The issue of discrimination that I have faced, I assume you face as well, is an issue of the heart. Mm-hmm. It's not Republicans or Democrats. Frankly, both sides of the aisle can do a better job on the issue of race. And frankly, my side of the aisle, I think, is doing a fabulous job of making progress. The question is, how do we measure that progress?
So really important that this is not, racism is not a Republican or a Democrat issue. It's a human issue. And so how do we get to that part of the conversation? I actually thought this was an interesting strategic play for Senator Scott as a candidate for president of the United States to go on to The View and to take on these questions. I think he did it in a pretty powerful way, a pretty important way. He clearly brought it from his own experience in saying that, yes, we have a long way to go on some of these issues, but this is all part of becoming a more perfect union. And so, as is always the case, we're going to stay with the question a little bit longer and talk about that experience. We're going to go from the politics to the social commentary, and we're going to land on the principles that can help us have a more important conversation about race in America. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to stay with the conversation. Former Representative Mia Love is going to join us to talk about her experience as a host on The View and her perspective on race conversations in America. We'll be right back.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
We're staying with the conversation just a little bit longer. If you're just joining us, earlier today, presidential candidate and South Carolina Senator Tim Scott appeared on The View to talk about racism. He had been criticized by Joy Behr, one of the hosts there on The View, saying that he did not understand the black experience in America. Senator Scott chose to go on and to address things head on. And in the last segment, we talked about the appeal of his message to that audience in particular and beyond. And so we want to stay with that and dig into not just the identity politics, because we have to get past that, and not just the interesting social commentary around The View and their audience, but to get to the principle that can help all of us have better conversations when it comes to race. And so we're really thrilled to have back on the program someone who has a very unique perspective on all of this, former Congresswoman Mia Love, who, of course, was the first black Republican woman in the House of Representatives. She's also been a guest host on The View and has been one to lead out in amazing conversations with the Congressional Black Caucus and others about how we do this a little bit different. And Mia, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Boyd. I watched the interview and I thought Tim was absolutely phenomenal because he was honest and straightforward. I loved it.
Yeah, I thought he did an amazing job of going right to the heart of the issues in terms of what was said and what he'd actually lived and experienced. And before we dive into that, though, give us a quick snapshot. You've sat in the chair there on The View as the lone conservative Republican voice on the panel. And just give us some sense of your experience there.
It's really interesting because one of the reasons why I like certain hosts on CNN is because they give you the space that you need to make your point, to speak. You know, one of the things that's really difficult, as they asked him a question and he said, let me lay it down for you, all of the Republican achievements for the black community, all of the Republican achievements, period. Let me lay it out for you. You hear Whoopi just say, no, well, sorry, gotta go, can't do it. It's gotta go. Yeah, no, sorry, gotta go. It's like they don't want to hear it. They just don't want to hear it. And I felt so frustrated because I remember I was making my points and it was just, it's almost like they know, oh crap, this is not going to work with our narrative. So let's just cut this off and move on to something else.
Yeah.
And I saw that happen a lot with Tim.
Yeah, there were definitely some points where the host got uncomfortable with where Senator Scott was going in terms of really painting that picture. And so as we look at that, some of the things that I thought he said that were most interesting and would love your take on all of these, Mia. One, just looking at this idea of if the message to minorities of any kind, that you have to be the exception in order to be successful in this country. He said that was dangerous. Give us some perspective on that.
It is dangerous because it creates an attitude of being a victim. Now, I'm going to say candidly, because this fits what we're talking about perfectly. When I won the race in the Congressional 4th District, I would shout out to everyone in the country, in the world, exactly where I came from. I would say, yes, believe it or not, I am a representative from the state of Utah, because they don't care about what color I am, what gender I am. They care more about feeding their families. They care more about chasing their version of the American dream. And that's why when that happens, racism goes away. They just vote for the candidate that's going to protect their freedoms. And so I was always incredibly proud to talk about being from the state of Utah. And it's unfortunate because it was the National Democrats that had Ben McAdams run to remove the first and only black Republican female in the state of Utah or in Congress, period.
Yeah.
It wasn't, Republicans didn't do that. Democrats did that. They didn't care about evening out the playing field. They didn't care about making sure that Black Americans had a voice or females had a voice. They cared more about power than they did about the message that they were sending with me there.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the narrative that we've got to get to beyond this identity politics. And you've spoken out a lot about this, both when you were in Congress and since in your appearances on CNN and in so many other places in the book that you had come out earlier this year. And talked about how, look, as long as we continue to play the identity politics of it all, nothing changes. And you were one who was willing to go into places where maybe you weren't expected or maybe even not welcome to have the conversation, a different conversation.
I was getting comfortable in uncomfortable spaces because I knew that that is right there in the center of all of that is where changes, good changes were made. Being a member of the Congressional Black Caucus was not comfortable. It was uncomfortable many times, but then it got comfortable. And guess what? They started to trust me, and we started making some changes. The Congressional Black Caucus started seeing me not as an opposition, but as a voice in the Republican conference where they might be able to get a word in. In the tax cut, in our legislation, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we were able to get tax cuts or actually tax relief for people who were taking care of their elderly parents. That idea actually that seed was planted in my head from the Congressional Black Caucus. And I said, yes, I can fight for that. I want more people, if they're taking care of their elderly parents, to be able to save money or get more money, keep more of their money so they can take care of their elderly parents.
Yeah.
That to me is very American. We should do that. And so that actually came from me being in the Congressional Black Caucus. So they were happy with that. And we ended up getting a better bill because of that.
Yeah. And it's so vital that we get to that space again. And whether we're talking about race or gender or ethnicity or sexual orientation, whatever it may be, we have to be in a space where we can get past just calling each other names or just screaming talking points, but actually get to the table.
We have to be able to sit at a table and talk about things respectfully that we disagree with. And remember, I talked about this idea. There's one word that really is missing from Congress is acknowledgement. If both sides can acknowledge the same thing, we would be able to work on it. If both sides can acknowledge that Republicans have done quite a bit to help Americans, to help Black Americans. Tim talked about the fact that we brought unemployment down to 5.64%, the lowest level in history in this country for when it comes to unemployment in Black Americans. We should acknowledge that, because if we can acknowledge that together, we can do more of it.
Yeah.
The more we can acknowledge where the problems are or acknowledge where the good is, we can do more. So it's just being able to admit or see.
Yeah. So important. That's going to be the word of the day today is acknowledge, whether you're acknowledging the problem or acknowledging the success. That is where
we start
to transcend it all. Former Representative Mia Love, thank you so much for carving out time today. Unique perspective on a unique day on The View and
I am so glad that Tim's in the race. My uncle, who is a, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, called me from Florida and he said, oh my gosh, Tim might be the person that makes me vote Republican.
You
or Tim. It's either you or Tim.
And it all started on The View.
And I asked him, I said, well, why is that? Why is it? Why would it just be you or Tim? He's like, because I trust you. I've heard you both. And I feel like you understand what is needed in America. I trust you both.
Awesome. Great
stuff.
So
that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
It's great to see that Tim is gaining the trust and the acknowledgement of some of the things that he is saying in people all across America. He's going to be really refreshing
in this
large field of candidates.
Yeah, great stuff. Great insight as always. Former Representative Mia Love, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Boyd.
All right, so over the last 30 minutes, we've taken a look at Tim Scott on The View, Mia Love, former substitute host on The View, talking about race in America in a very different kind of way. But it starts, as the representative said, with acknowledgement, acknowledging the good, acknowledging the mistakes, acknowledging It's about moving towards a more perfect union, which is what Tim Scott said on The View today. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, it is a very busy week in presidential politics, to be sure. And we're going to stay with that just a little bit as we look to Nikki Haley, who was, of course, one of the first to jump in the race for 2024 on the Republican side. And last night during a CNN town hall in Iowa, the Republican candidate answered some pretty hard-hitting questions from host Jake Tapper and GOP caucus voters from the Hawkeye State. Topics ranged from the U.S. support of Ukraine to abortion rights to Border Patrol. And she made some pretty interesting and pretty compelling points while addressing all of those. So we want to dig through just a little bit to see what you might have missed on a Sunday evening in Iowa. While addressing the issue of the war between Russia and Ukraine, Nikki Haley emphasized that Ukraine has to win.
A win for Ukraine is a win for all of us because tyrants tell us exactly what they're going to do. What we heard, China said they were going to take Hong Kong. They did it. Russia said they were going to invade Ukraine. We watched that happen. China says Taiwan's next. We better believe them. Russia said Poland and the Baltics are next. If that happens, we're looking at a world war. This is about preventing war. And so the way you prevent war is not that we give cash to Ukraine, not that we put troops on the ground, but that we get with our allies and we make sure that we give them the equipment and the ammunition to win. Because when Ukraine wins, that sends a message to China with Taiwan. It sends a message to Iran that wants to build a bomb. It sends a message to North Korea testing ballistic missiles. And it sends a message to Russia that it's over. That's what we have to do. And keep in mind, everybody wants to know, well, how does this war end? It would end in a day if Russia would pull out. If Ukraine pulls out, then we're all looking at a world war.
Pretty compelling and pretty unique perspective from Nikki Haley, of course, as she fulfilled her role as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. She understands the dynamics, the interaction that goes on there, and had some pretty interesting things to say around that. When she was asked about abortion, she said the discussion should not be about our differences, but about what we can all agree on and how you move that conversation forward in a different way.
Don't let anyone in the media, don't let any political party tell you that a Republican president can ban abortion laws in our country because they can't any more than a Democrat president can ban our state laws. So what can we do with consensus? That's exactly what it is. We come through with consensus and say, what can we all agree on? I think we can all agree on banning late-term abortions. I think we can all agree on encouraging adoptions and making sure those foster kids feel more love, not less. I think we can agree on doctors and nurses who don't believe in abortion shouldn't have to perform them. I think we can agree on the fact that contraception should be accessible. And I think we can all come together and say any woman that has an abortion shouldn't be jailed or given the death penalty. Can't we start there?
So that was a really interesting exchange. I watched that a couple of times between her and Jake Tapper from CNN. And as they went through and as she really laid out the things that everyone agrees on and where the vast majority of the nation is as it relates to abortion. And the late-term abortion, clearly there's a lot of consensus across the political spectrum, across the religious perspective. Everyone gets that part of it. So let's start with that and build on that. And so I thought it was very interesting for Nikki Haley to take that on in a way that I think many people were not expecting her to go down during that town hall in Iowa last night. The topic also shifted to the border. And as Nikki Haley is the only candidate this cycle who's been down to the border, again, she's coming at it from a place of perspective. She's seen what happens to the people crossing the fence and what comes next.
I am the only candidate that has not just talked about it. I'm the only candidate this cycle that's actually gone to the border. I went to 400 miles of that border. You're not ready for what I saw. When you get up in the morning, you get your coffee and you watch the news. When these ranchers get up in the morning, they get their coffee and they go see if anyone died trying to cross the fence. They pick up whatever little kids were left behind and they turn them over to Border Patrol. I met with multiple sheriffs, and they said before 7 a.m. they round up illegal immigrants, the ones they can capture. They turn them over to Border Patrol. And then Border Patrol documents them and releases them until their court date years from now. And then when I asked Border Patrol about their job, they said, "Do you want to know what our job is? We're glorified babysitters. They don't let us do our job."
Nikki Haley went on to talk about an actual plan for fixing the issues at the border.
When I was governor, I passed one of the toughest illegal immigration laws in the country. We did a mandatory E-Verify program that made businesses prove that the people they hired were here legally. We will do a national E-Verify program. We will defund sanctuary cities once and for all. We will stop giving the hundreds of billions of dollars of handouts to illegal immigrants. We will go back to remain in Mexico because guess what? Nobody wants to remain in Mexico. We will keep the provisions of Title 42. And instead of catch and release, we will go to catch and deport. That is the way we will stop the bleeding on our border. We have to do this.
So again, very specific in terms of her approach from a policy perspective. And whether you agree with Nikki Haley's approach or not, she articulated it very clearly, very passionately, and I would say very well. And that's the kind of conversations we should expect in our politics. When we have people running for office, they can have that kind of conversation. And again, you don't have to agree with them at all. It's not about agreeing. It's not about kumbaya and group hugs. It's about having a different kind of conversation. Now, one of the other topics that Nikki Haley addressed in the CNN town hall in Iowa last night was another pretty hot button topic of gun control and what steps we need to take to protect our children from mass shootings. Take a listen.
Let's start focusing on what we can deal with. First of all, let's get illegal guns off the street. Let's have the backs of law enforcement. Let's get illegal guns off the street. Secondly, let's make sure when it comes to our schools, secure our schools. There should be one point of entry. There should be a law enforcement officer at every school. We should make sure there's the clear bulletproof tape that we have at courthouses and airports. We should have that on our schools to protect them. And we should have a mental health counselor at every single school, not a guidance counselor, but a mental health counselor. Then we need to make sure that the feds actually vet properly. When I talked about the church shooting that we had, that murderer, when he went to go buy a gun, because the feds didn't do it in the time allotted, they gave him the gun anyway. He should never have gotten it. It would have been flagged that he wasn't supposed to have one. So first, let's have the feds do the job they're supposed to do already.
So again, whether you think that's the right policy or not, it's a pretty reasonable, pretty rational approach to having the conversation about it and to find some common ground in terms of what needs to be done. And I think there were multiple things that Nikki Haley said in that conversation that people on the political left and the political right would agree with in terms of how we go about it. And so as we've been moving through the show today, I really wanted to highlight these conversations from Nikki Haley on CNN, from Tim Scott on The View, so that you can just hear what having a different kind of conversation sounds like. Because sadly, I think as we get closer to Labor Day and as things really start to heat up in these campaigns, you're going to hear a lot of the old, what we've become accustomed to kind of politics of using every pejorative you can think or enunciate in front of your opponent's name to play to the base emotions of anger, fear, and frustration. I didn't hear that from either Tim Scott or Nikki Haley on any of those issues. And those were all the contentious possibilities. Tim Scott talking about race and racism and discrimination, talking about the need for education and upward mobility. Nikki Haley talking about gun control, abortion rights, immigration, and Ukraine. And so we can have conversations around principles and policies. And here's the challenge for all of us as voters, as citizens. We need to make sure that we're rewarding those who are having the higher level conversation, as opposed to continuing to click on the clickbait, the outrageous, that lands someone some really nice fundraising emails or a spot on a cable news network. So you've heard just over the last 45 minutes some people who are having conversations in a different way about all the issues that Americans think are the most important issues. So we can do this. It can be done. It's how we choose to do it that will be the determining factor of where the country goes next. All right, we're going to step aside for a quick break. When we come back, America might be having a Swedish moment when it comes to Social Security. We're going to talk about what that means. Coming up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Well, America clearly has a Social Security crisis. Despite all of the artificial crises we often talk about it from Washington, D.C., this one's real. But nobody's doing anything about it. And this might be a moment we might look somewhere else. I don't know, maybe even to Sweden for some solutions. And someone who's actually thought this all the way through, Jay Evenson, the opinion editor at the Deseret News, wrote about this over the weekend. And Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, boys. Good to be back.
All right. So is this a Swedish moment when it comes to Social Security? I keep telling people that nobody wants to deal with this, and everyone's just kind of hoping that it'll be okay, but hope is not a strategy. Does Sweden have some answers for us?
It could be a Swedish moment, but we'd have to adopt a sort of Swedish sensibility, and we don't seem to have that. They approached this very crisis that we're approaching about 30 years ago, and they decided to level with people, to have, if you will, an adult conversation with the voters and let them know what was happening. And they came up with a pretty good idea that saved their Social Security system and actually gave the people a pretty good return on their investments. Are we capable of doing that? Well, we have to get rid of the political rhetoric if we're going to do that and quit trying to pretend that we don't really have a problem, because I've been on your show before and I've referred to this as the slowest moving man-made disaster in history. We can all see it coming.
Yeah.
And we need to do something about it now.
Yeah. And you had a great quote in your piece at Deseret.com saying that President Biden refuses to consider any reforms. Republicans have jumped on that for political purposes. But that's not going to save the program. It's actually going to do what you just described, the slowest moving major catastrophe ever.
The interesting thing, and Sweden's been known for decades as a model socialist country, right? A free socialist country. The truth is they've moved away from that quite a bit over the last 30, 40 years. And an interesting part of their new Social Security system is that it includes investments in private funds. So every worker gets to invest 2.3% of their wages per year, and they can choose from, I think it's among five different funds to invest in. And then they also have a considerable amount that goes into a guaranteed fund. But this guaranteed fund gives them a return every year of about 2%. The private investment fund gives a return of about 10%. Mm. And that's despite all the dot-com crisis and the recession, everything we've had, which has affected them as well over the last 30 years. Because I think we all instinctively know that the stock market will pay off over time.
Yeah.
But of course, in this country, we immediately label that as a right-wing plan, and the Democrats don't want to talk about it. And so we'll never get there unless we can put that aside and look at this with a clear eye.
Yeah, and it is. It's having that honest conversation, getting everything on the table. And you do have to consider everything. When you're facing a crisis, everything's on the table and you have to look at it. But again, everyone's so afraid of their political shadow, of who might primary them or who might go after them with a campaign ad based on saying, hey, we need to look at or fix Social Security. And you get demonized, your words get weaponized. And one of the things I love that you pointed out was that both Utah senators have come up with some pretty interesting possible solutions, or at least pieces to pieces of a possible solution.
Yes. Well, Mitt Romney has the Trust Act, which would set up committees to study these programs that rely on trust funds, including the Federal Highway Trust Fund. And he would mandate that these committees find ways to keep the program solvent in the long term. Now, he's already been demonized for that and said, well, he wants to dismantle Social Security and Medicare. No, that's not what he's saying.
Right.
And then Senator Lee, he wants to index the retirement age to life expectancy, and he wants people to invest some of their Social Security contributions in private accounts, which is what Sweden is doing. But that's been labeled as crazy, because what if the stock market collapses? Well, that assumes that you're going to be taking everything out of your account at the same time, which you're not. And as I already said, with Sweden, they've shown that they've been able to weather some pretty tough times and still come out ahead with a plan like that.
Yeah, so important to just change the dynamic of the conversation. So rather than just shouting the talking points from the spectrum of the politics of it all, if you start saying, okay, let's look at a couple of principles around this policy, and let's see if there's some places we can actually get going. Anything else you noticed, Jay, in your exploration of what Sweden has done that might be applicable, or things that we ought to be thinking about as hopefully somebody decides to be the adult in the room and say, we have to have a conversation about this?
Well, there are five main political parties in Sweden, and the Social Democrats have been the largest party typically for many years. But they somehow breached the politics and got in line with the more right-wing parties or the moderate parties over there. And it made me think of Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, who came together back in the 80s and solved what was a crisis at that time for Social Security. We have this in our DNA. We know how to do it. We just need the politicians with the courage to step out of the current rhetoric and make this happen. And I think the voters will go along if you level with them and say, here's the problem, spell it out. Here's why we have to do this. We're going to make sure that people who are retiring soon are kept whole, but we're going to maybe change things for the younger workers. I think Americans would respect and go along with that.
Great insight, as always. It's a great piece. You can check it out at Deseret.com. Of course, Jay Evenson is the opinion editor there for the Deseret News and one of the great voices here in the state of Utah. Jay, thanks for giving us a little Swedish perspective today as it comes to Social Security. Always appreciate the insight.
Thank you, Boyd.
All right. Again, that's Jay Evenson, opinion editor at the Deseret News. And again, it's not that Sweden has all the answers or has the perfect model, but they started in the right place. And the right place was to have a serious conversation about the problem. It actually goes back to what former Representative Mia Love said earlier in the show. In talking about race and talking about what's being done for inner cities and upward mobility, you have to acknowledge where you are. And if both sides can acknowledge, here's what's going right, here's what's going wrong, here's the current reality, and here's what we need to do better, then you can start having a conversation and you can explore all kinds of possibilities that always get you to a better solution. But if all we do is just weaponize the words, if we can't get past what we saw earlier this year with President Biden weaponizing those who said, hey, we have to look at Social Security in the next 10 years or it's going to go insolvent, and weaponizing that even in the State of the Union to say they want to cut it and get rid of it and it's going to hurt seniors, which nobody had said. It just wasn't true. And if those on the right are unwilling to say, look, we've got to do some things differently, whether that's revenue, because that's all you got, or cut spending, that's all you got. You got to have a different kind of conversation. But let's start with an honest conversation. Let's start with a real conversation. And whether it's dealing with Social Security, whether it's the border, whether it's guns, whether it's race and racism, we can do this. Jay Evenson was right. It's in our DNA to do this. Let's not let the politics prevent us from doing what we know we can do. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. Big hour number two coming up next. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the headlines beginning in February of last year when Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine is that Vladimir Putin is pretty good at drawing red lines. He's threatened retaliation for any kind of negotiations. He's talked about nuclear warfare. He's talked about the U.S. and allies doing any kind of things that would constrict or restrict what Russia was doing. Since then, the West has crossed many of those red lines, even the bright red lines, without even blinking. So why is it that President Biden in particular and the Secretary of State seem to be so comfortable just stepping right across Vladimir Putin's red lines? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
We're thrilled to have joining us on the program today John Hudson, national security reporter focusing on the State Department and diplomacy for The Washington Post, and just had a fantastic piece over the weekend that is talking about something that no one's really talking about. And so we always love to get beyond the headlines there. And John, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you.
So your piece in The Washington Post over the weekend talking about Vladimir Putin and his red line brigade that he keeps rolling out there. And interestingly, that President Biden seems to be getting pretty comfortable in moving across those.
Yeah, that's exactly right. At the outset of this war on February 24th, Vladimir Putin gave a speech saying if any countries interfere with this invasion of Ukraine, they will experience consequences which have never been seen before. And since that time, the United States has given Ukraine an increasingly sophisticated array of defense equipment and materials, missiles, rockets, tanks, and soon fourth-generation fighter jets. And each step along the way, Putin has redrawn his red line, saying, if you send HIMARS rocket launchers, if you send Stinger missiles, if you send tanks, this will be a red line. And each time he has failed to retaliate against other countries in the United States, in the Western alliance, it hasn't. And so the piece really captured the willingness by Biden to cross those red lines. But also the dangerous part about this conflict being that the red lines are only in one person's head, and that's Vladimir Putin. So even though he has failed to reinforce his red line, no one is positive about what red line is actually a real one. And that's what makes the conflict so dangerous.
Yeah. And I want to get into some of that conflict and that the danger zone. Obviously, the nuclear threat is the one I think everyone says, OK, that's got to be the reddest of the red lines. But before that, I want to get into just kind of some of the positioning from the president. Obviously, he's talked about one of the recent big steps was, of course, saying that we would help train those fighter jets and those pilots. And so give us a sense of kind of that progression. And what do you think that looks like from the Secretary of State? I know you spend a lot of time traveling and covering the Secretary of State. But what does that look like from the administration and from the president?
Yeah, well, so you're right to bring up the Secretary of State because Antony Blinken is one of Biden's closest confidants. And I spoke closely to his aide about how Blinken has advised the president on this issue. And from Blinken's standpoint, he has grown increasingly confident each step of the way when they've given smaller provisions and larger provisions and more lethal and more sophisticated provisions of weaponry. Watching that, he just has lost all confidence that Putin's red lines mean anything. And so he's really been a key player within the Biden administration to push the president and push Western allies to do more and provide more. And that's because on the battlefield, these weapons have made a huge difference. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, the Ukraine's capital remains free and protected. And even though it's undergoing, you know, extremely lethal barrages of Russian missiles and in some cases hypersonic missiles, it has been able to defend itself and provide a quality of life to Ukrainians that people couldn't even imagine at the outset of this conflict. So that's, you know, Blinken has been really key in pushing harder for more sophisticated weaponry, and the president has followed that guidance. His main sort of guidance to his aides is, look, we're going to help the Ukrainians, But we, the United States, cannot become directly involved in this conflict, a direct conflict with Russia. And so far he's been able to meet those two criteria. But how long we can do that, one of the great mysteries of this conflict.
Yeah, for sure. And so give us some insight on that nuclear front. Obviously, I think there's a couple of components to that. One, just the nuclear option itself in terms of whether those are small tactical nuclear weapons or what they may be. And so there's this element to me, it seems, between the U.S. and then kind of the NATO allies. And of course, with NATO, I think, feeling a little emboldened. How does that all play into that?
Well, the red lines when it comes to nuclear use are the most closely watched red line. And U.S. officials sort of privately, when they're thinking about this and talking about this, they do think that there are certain things that could turn this conflict into a catastrophic sort of nuclear event. And then some of the fears are things like, you know, the recapture of Crimea. There are a lot of worries that could be a red line. Other fears are, attacks inside Russia that are extremely successful. What U.S. officials have told me is there's different types of escalation they have to worry about. You know, one, you mentioned a tactical nuclear weapon. This is like a smaller, low-yield nuclear weapon. One escalation that would be catastrophic and awful would be taking out a Ukrainian city with a nuclear weapon. That would obviously be, a horrendous event that should be avoided at all costs. The other possibility would be, you know, the detonation of a nuclear weapon outside of Ukraine as sort of a show of strength against Western allies. These are all things that the United States wants to try to avoid. And so far, there are also things that Russia has avoided. We don't know exactly why. It could be because the use of nuclear weapons would be a red line for some of Russia's key backers. The Chinese have said any use of a nuclear weapon would be unacceptable and it discouraged Russia from doing so. But that remains an unknown. There is a thinking that if Russia is really on its back foot and it looks like it's facing total defeat, that could also be a trigger of the use of a nuclear weapon. But really no one can be certain for sure.
Yeah, and then last question for you, John, quickly. I know you've spent a lot of time in Ukraine. I know you were there last year. I think you've got another venture going there. As you see things on the ground, which is always so different from anything we see anywhere else, what is it that you're sensing? And what is it, whether it's relating to the red lines or the strength of the Ukrainians or the ineptness of the Russians, what is it that you're watching or looking for that we're not really talking about?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's always surprised me, and one of the most difficult things to read from the outside, is where the momentum is in the conflict and what direction is it going in. Yeah. Right now, we're on the precipice of Ukraine's counteroffensive, and it's going to be quite interesting to see what happens, and it potentially could be extremely important for the total outcome of the war. Today, you have Russia claiming to have stopped a multi-front offensive by the Ukrainians. Their U.S. officials are looking to see whether or not this is actually the full-fledged beginning of the counteroffensive. But the reality is we're not going to know for a little bit. And some of the grimmest stories and also the signs of success are ones that are only visible there in Ukraine when you're in, you know, a military hospital, talking to soldiers who face off against Russians and how well equipped they were, how well equipped the Russians were, what their level of confidence is to fight longer and farther. And so we're just going to be able to see that in the coming weeks. A final thing I wanted to mention is people have asked, you know, why hasn't Russia reinforced its red lines? Why haven't the Russians hit harder against the West or other European countries? And a lot of U.S. officials believe that is basically related to the starry state of the Russian military. Mm-hmm. This conflict has gone much worse than the Russians had anticipated, and they have taken immense amount of losses, hundreds of thousands of casualties, according to U.S. officials. And so that's where the confidence also comes on the U.S. side, where they believe that Russia does not want to pick a fight with NATO right now. It's not in a position to. That doesn't mean that they're not able to use a nuclear weapon. At one point, they certainly have that ability. But when it comes to facing off with NATO in a conventional realm using conventional weapons. They're just not in a great place to do that.
Fantastic insight, John Hudson, national security reporter focusing on the State Department and diplomacy. Fantastic insight over the weekend, The Washington Post. Biden shows growing appetite to cross Putin's red line. John, thanks so much for just some fantastic perspective. Be safe in the travels, and we'll look forward to having you back on the show soon.
No, thanks for taking an interest.
All right, some really interesting beyond-the-headline things that we haven't been talking about as it relates to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the strength that Ukraine has and the willingness of the United States and many others to cross Vladimir Putin's red line. Does it mean that Vladimir Putin really is functioning from a position of weakness? Does that mean we should lean in more or let the status quo play out? Lots to think about beyond the headlines as it relates to Ukraine and driving Russia out of their sovereign territory.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Of course, over the weekend, President Biden signed the debt ceiling deal, and the bill included some permitting reforms for energy projects, but did lawmakers go far enough? There's a lot of red tape out there in energy projects that everyone has to manage their way through. We've talked about that before, but what did this bill actually do? Is it enough? What still needs to be done, and how should we be going about it? And so we always turn, of course, to Phil Rossetti, resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, focused on energy, climate, and environmental policy. And Phil, as you look at the permitting reforms that were part of the debt ceiling increase and spending reform package that the president signed over the weekend, you noted that maybe this was a great match or maybe it was a match made in purgatory. Where are we?
Well, I think it's more of the purgatory aspect. Yeah, they really didn't get everything that a permitting deal should encompass. But I think it's also important to keep in mind the context, which is it's surprising that they got anything in this deal at all, which I think is kind of a testament to the progress. But in terms of what was in there was one was a requirement that the agencies have to basically produce their environmental impact statements in under 2 years, which, it's significant, but that might also have brought some other challenges because if there are other reasons that it's taking longer, it's not going to address those. But it does allow for more accountability than there has been in the past for these long delays. There are also some changes to the language of the National Environmental Policy Act to clarify what is and is not a major federal action that requires significant review. And there are also some minor aspects about the ability to use documents that have already been prepared. So this is something that comes up occasionally where there are already assessments out there, but the government just doesn't say that you can use them as part of your analysis or impact statement. So this allows for more of that. So it's good. I'd say it's a good chunk of what Republicans have wanted, but it's not everything. And it's certainly not everything that has been considered in a permitting deal in the past.
Yeah, and I think it's important too, and you point this out anytime you're doing something in a must-pass piece of legislation, you rarely get it right, and sometimes you get it more wrong than you get it right under those circumstances. But one of the things that you pointed out that I thought was really important is that some of these moderate changes or modest changes end up allowing Congress to kind of pick the winners and losers because they're just picking little pieces they think they can get across the line in that kind of deal.
Yeah, and one of the interesting aspects of that was the Mountain Valley Pipeline was one of the bargaining chips. And, no judgment on the MVP, that's a whole separate issue. But the fact that getting something like this permitted has to happen through must-pass legislation is kind of in and of itself a problem. We don't want to have a sort of permitting priority where Congress or politics are governing what projects get through. We want these projects to compete on their merit. So it's good that there's some improvement to the process overall in this, but some of the things that are still missing are the statute of limitations question, addressing the judicial review, the litigation risks. Those are things that we've seen have really driven the timelines up because it's such an easy tactic to sue projects. So addressing that is still something that's on the table. But also Democrats did not get any of their big priorities on permitting reform through with this. They really didn't manage to get the community engagement processes changed at all. And they also have not really addressed the transmission aspects that they've been very keen on in their clean energy push. So still a lot left to do.
Yeah. And one of the things that you pointed out that I think is also really interesting is the fact that because neither side really got all the way to where they wanted to get, and that many on the left trying to get some of these clean and green energy projects through that are now suddenly experiencing all of those delays and all the things that come with that permitting process. Does this mean that there is an appetite for more of this, and could we do it in something that's not must-pass legislation?
You know, I'm actually pretty optimistic on that. I think there is an appetite for more because I think what's going to happen is a lot of the Democrats are going to hear from the industries that they're more favorable to, the clean energy industry, and they're going to tell them, they're going to say, hey, you know, this doesn't go all the way. It doesn't address all of our big issues. That's going to be an impetus for kind of more discussion. It might not be in must-pass legislation, or it might be on its own. It's hard to say at this point. But most of what the Republicans have wanted, since they got so much of it through with the debt deal, it makes it a little bit easier for a negotiation process where some of the big priorities for the Republicans that are still outstanding are not too offensive to the Democrats, and they might be able to say, hey, you know, overall we're getting more out of this permitting deal than we expected. And that's, I think, a testament to McCarthy's negotiating strategy, where he managed to get pretty much only Republican priorities through in the debt limit deal, and Democrats really didn't get much of any of their priorities through. So it creates an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and that will be the interesting thing moving forward. And so what are you watching for as this kind of moves into a next phase now, again, outside of the calamity, catastrophe, whatever disaster was coming that didn't happen mode?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think what is going to be most interesting is seeing how the Democrats start to shape up a counter-proposal on permitting, since the Republicans have still proposed some legislation, which still has some aspects that were not in the debt limit deal. So most of that's probably going to come out of the Senate, since the House essentially got some of its priorities through with the Builder Act, which was attached to the debt limit deal. And that's going to start to foster this discussion. And as it comes through, there's going to be negotiations, hearings. And if they land somewhere that they want and they can pass it bipartisanly, that's great. But if they're really struggling, then we could see it attached to another must-pass legislation, which is something that's become more and more common with the sort of politics of a divided government like what we have now.
Yeah. And then final question for you, Phil. If you were in the room, what's the one place that you would say, let's start here when it comes to permitting reform?
Definitely the judicial review. You know, this has been a big thing where pretty much any project is going to get sued, and that makes it so the agencies have to address a pretty much infinite level of risk in their environmental impact statements because they just don't always know what has to be covered. So having reforms that say, hey, there's a shorter statute of limitations to challenge these projects, and on top of that, people who challenge the projects have to actually submit comments that say what is deficient on the agency's part and what they have to address, gives a lot more clarity where they can at least say, hey, we know exactly what we need to address for environmental issues. We're going to cover in our environmental impact statement and just get that problem sorted out before the government has to issue a decision instead of having the court sort it out. That, I think, would go a long way.
Yeah. Great insight as always. Phil Rossetti, resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. He's focused on energy, climate, and environmental policy. Always gives us great perspective there. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Some great perspective there in terms of some of the permitting reform that did get done, what was included in the deal that the president signed over the weekend, what yet needs to be done and dealt with in order to streamline those things. And that's for all kinds of energy, whether it's some of the more traditional forms of energy, of oil and gas, or whether it's green energy and some of the new technologies. Everybody is dealing with these very slow processes that can take years, even up to a decade, can cost millions of dollars and derail these programs, which make it less likely that businesses are going to want to invest and take the risk not knowing what the permitting is going to be or what the lawsuits might look like. So that is an area where I think there is an appetite for some reform on both the left and the right. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as we move into the fall this year as well. All right, we're going to step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. First Lady of the state of Utah, Abby Cox, is going to join us next with an important initiative that you might just want to show up for. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, we always close out this show by offering an invitation to go out and do something that makes a difference. Well, Utah's First Lady Abby Cox strongly believes in making a difference, and she believes that you do that by showing up. And it is time for her Show Up for Service initiative. And the First Lady joins us on the line. Abby, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So give everyone a good sneak peek. What does Show Up for Service initiative, what does that look like this year?
Well, this year, just like last year, we're having a great party to kick off the summer. Bring your family, bring your kids, bring your worker, your coworkers. Anybody that wants to come, we are inviting you to Thanksgiving Point Electric Park to have a great opportunity to have some fun, but also to connect with some great nonprofits that have volunteer and service opportunities for your family to get involved all summer long.
Oh, fantastic. And that event, again, is today from 4 to 8 p.m. Out of Thanksgiving Point Electric Park there in Lehi, Utah. And Abby, as you've had the opportunity to do this going on a second year now, give us a sense of what you saw come out of last year's event and what it really meant to the community.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is that we have incredible people throughout the state, families. They want their kids to get involved in service, and we love that. A lot of times they just don't know where. They don't know where the opportunities are to volunteer. They don't know the groups, the organizations that are doing these projects and needing volunteers. And then we have a whole, you know, thousands of nonprofits throughout the state that need volunteers. And they're looking for families that are ready to volunteer. So this, what's come out of this event last year and what will be even bigger and better this year is the ability to connect our families with people, do the organizations that are doing this work that need the volunteers. And it's really a matchmaking opportunity, but it's also an opportunity to have a great time. We'll have bounce houses. We'll have cotton candy. We'll have food trucks. We'll have music. It'll be a blast, but you're going to have great opportunities to connect with people and opportunities to volunteer.
And I love you use that word connect, because it is about connecting. And one of the great ways that we do connect to other people is through service and just through going out and making a difference each day. I know a lot of parents are already starting to calculate how are they going to keep their kids engaged over the course of the summer, 1 week into the summer. And you talk about this in terms of putting your kids' wiggles to work. How important is it for us to engage our kids in this? And what is it that our kids can really do to catch the vision of this Show Up?
You know, it's really interesting. We've been known in Utah as the service state, as the volunteerism state, and charitable giving. And we're always number one for that. But unless we're intentional about perpetuating this through the next generations, it may not always be that way. And what we know is that when we serve and when we volunteer and when we look outside of ourselves and we teach our children to do that, we know that that is connected to better mental health, better physical health. We know that our youth and our kids are struggling with anxiety and depression. And the best thing that we can do for them, besides, you know, of course, if you need any other medication or anything like that, but really, truly, some of the best things that we can do is to get them out there volunteering, helping other people, connecting with people that maybe have a different story than they do. It's a beautiful thing when we see those things happen, when we see kids connecting in really special ways. it means a lot for our state, and we want to keep that going. We want to be very intentional about that as we move into the next generation.
So important, and I love that you're connecting that to mental health and well-being. It is so true. We often think we need to pamper our kids when they're having a bad day or when they're struggling to overcome a setback or a challenge or some discouragement, and often it is getting outside of yourself that really creates that opportunity. If you're just joining us, we have First Lady from the state of Utah, Abby Cox, on the line. And today's a big day. This afternoon from 4 to 8 p.m. out at Thanksgiving Point Electric Park there in Lehi, it is time for Show Up and Serve. And a great opportunity, as the First Lady mentioned, they'll have bounce houses, yard games, chalk art, food painting and face trucks. Food trucks and face painting. We'll go with that. And just an opportunity for all of us to celebrate what Utah does incredibly well. And as you said, Abby, to take it up another level. What's the one thing that you think we ought to be talking about a little bit more when it just comes to that idea of neighbor to neighbor, community to community, really making a difference?
Yeah, you know, I would say that we need less division and more coming together in ways that just serve each other and connect. I have to say, like, we look around and we see a lot of people starting to realize that social media has been damaging to our youth and to ourselves. And really, this is an opportunity for us to put away the phones, put away everything else, really connect as humans. You know, rain or shine today, this afternoon, I'm heading down there right now. I'm hoping for great weather, but rain or shine, we're going to come together with some over 50 nonprofits that are going to be there that you can connect with. You can find ways to serve. You can find ways I've met with many of these nonprofits. They do amazing work. I'm super excited for everyone to get to meet them, connect with them, figure out ways to serve.
And it's so great. Once those happen, I hope those are the things that we choose to share on social media, as opposed to the usual stuff that gets tossed out there of ways that we have made a difference or the ways that we have engaged in our society. Such an important thing. First Lady of the state of Utah, who is modeling what it looks like to show up for service, what it means to really make a difference. Abby Cox, thank you so much for joining us today on Inside Sources.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Again, that's First Lady Abby Cox joining us. It's the second year that they have done Show Up for Service initiative. And this is one you just ought to do. One, it'll be a blast and it's going to be really fun. A great opportunity for you to be out with your family, with the kids, with the neighbors, and getting out there and exploring possibilities of how do you go about serving and what are the opportunities out there. You'd be surprised at how many ways and how many different opportunities there really are. The event is co-hosted by Show Up, by Just Serve, by You Serve Utah, and Thanksgiving Point. They're all involved in this process with First Lady Abby Cox. And again, I think it's just an extraordinary thing. It's a very Utah model kind of way at looking at what are we doing? How do we do it better? How do we connect opportunities to serve with extraordinary people who know how to serve? And so check that out today, again, from 4 to 8 p.m. today out at Thanksgiving Point Electric Park there in Lehi. And all kinds of things from food trucks and radio and all kinds of things. Bring a lawn chair, bring a blanket, hang around, and learn about some great ways to make a difference in our community. We're going to go ahead and step aside for one last break. And when we come back, we're going to go full circle in terms of what is going on inside of Russia and actually some of the ways that the Russian citizens are doing exactly what First Lady Abby Cox just talked about, serving a neighbor in need. We'll talk about that coming up next. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And as we round out the program today, if you missed the last segment, we had Utah's First Lady Abby Cox on the line talking about an opportunity, year number two, for Show Up for Service. And a great event that will be happening out at Thanksgiving Point from 4 to 8 p.m. tonight, and opportunities for you to connect with organizations that need help in providing service to our fellow citizens here in the state of Utah. And that is something that is very centric to Utah. We talk about it often in the context of social capital. And just that neighbor helping neighbor in need is why we all should continue to have great confidence in our country, even in the midst of a lot of political discord. It is that community service. It is showing up for each other. That really is what keeps the country rolling along and what should give us great confidence in the future of the nation. But now I'm going to shift gears on you just a little bit, and we're going to talk about social capital in Russia. Now, that might seem like a place where you wouldn't expect to see social capital, but it does happen. It happens everywhere. I think it's human capital, and we often just don't see it. We often don't miss it. But there was a fascinating piece in the New York Times. Our good friend Kevin sent this along to me over the weekend that talked about what's happening inside of Russia. You may have heard that over the last few days of May, there were incursions into Russia, bombs falling inside of Russia, border towns there near the Ukrainian border. And what I want to focus on is not the military tactics and strategy of that, but I want you to consider and think about what has actually happened inside some of these border towns that suddenly find themselves in a war zone. And as you look at that, one of those towns, Shevchenko, it's a town of about 40,000. It's 6 miles from the border, and it has effectively become a new part of the front lines as Ukraine has intensified attacks and their counterattacks. There have been other military units, not necessarily aligned specifically with Ukraine, but have been making those incursions. Some of those have even been led by Russians into some of those border towns. But the thing that has happened after is the thing I want to talk about, because it's social capital. It's showing up. And it happens not just in America. It happens a lot of other places. I think it's in our DNA. And so there's been footage of shellings of this Belgorod area where there's been a lot of these bombings and things going inside. Again, this is inside of Russia. And the interesting thing that has taken place is the government, Vladimir Putin's government, has not been there to help. And so it's what's happened as a result that is the important thing. And while the society is a little bit disjointed at the moment, as everyone tries to figure out what this war inside of Ukraine means to the Russian people, it's been very interesting. The government has failed, but social capital and civil society have flourished. And there have been evacuations. They've been taking people to special places that were more safe, to sports arenas. And I think one of the most compelling things to me in all of this was that people just did it. They didn't need the government to do it, and they didn't need the government to tell them to do it. They just did it. And so this was the Russians, neighbor helping neighbor in need, helping to evacuate some of those who couldn't do it on their own. There was just these, it was almost like flash mobs, spontaneous civil society, spontaneous social capital being deployed, and some real capital. Some GoFundMes got started for some of those who had lost some things, and it has rekindled a grassroots civic spirit inside of Russia, born out of necessity. Because of the inadequacy of the local governments. The Russian government has been absolutely unable or unwilling to respond to the needs of their citizens inside these border towns that now have experienced bombings and those kinds of things. And this growing realization that they actually had to rely on each other, not on the government. And I think that's an important lesson for us. Again, it's one we often talk about on this show, that social capital is what makes it all go around. Social capital and civil society is what keeps things going, sometimes in spite of government, where government often gets in the way. I loved how the First Lady Abby Cox talked about that connective tissue and that muscle in our civil society that does help us respond to the better angels of our nature to just show up. And to just serve and to just make a difference. It's not rocket science and it's not complicated. Sometimes we outthink ourselves and make it complicated. But when we simplify it, we can see we can do something. We can't do everything, but we can do one thing. And we might even be able to do some things. We don't have to do it all. Reminds me a couple of years ago, back in it was actually back in 2016, during the course of that presidential campaign, I had a really interesting conversation with Megan McArdle, who was with Bloomberg at the time and is now with The Washington Post. But she actually wrote a piece about Utah being one of the few places in America where the American dream was still alive and well. And while we have problems, we have challenges in this state, to be sure. We have things we have to do way better than we've done in the past. But we also have a lot of good things going. And one of the things that was really striking, Megan McArdle, we took her around the state and connected her with different groups and individuals across the state for several days. And I'll never forget, she came back to my office after having been around and dealt with some different groups around intergenerational poverty, talking about different things in civil society. And she came back and she said, "Wow, I feel like I've been walking with Tocqueville for a couple of days." But this social capital that had been earned and amassed, and whether it had been deployed for refugees or those in poverty, was really stirring to her. And, you know, as a laboratory of democracy, we do have some things that are going well. We are making a difference in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of things that the country could learn from how Utah shows up and how Utah chooses to make a difference. And so, to me, the important thing from this lesson, again, from Russia, from Russian social capital, from Russian civil society, is that this doesn't have to be a national or international thing. It's just a human thing. And when we set all the politics aside, when we set all of the drama aside, often from big governments or big organizations, and we just look across the street or around the corner in our own neighborhood, and we all recognize that we can do something, that we can make a difference. And that should give us a lot of hope, not just for the country. That should give us a lot of hope for the world. And it was great to see Russian civil society and Russian social capital deployed in a time of need. The challenge for all of us is not to wait to a time of need, but to show up right now. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and yes, do something. Show up and make a difference. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.